This is the Ingles Information Aisle with Leah McGrath, helping you eat healthy, feel great, and understand your nutrition. Now, here's your host, Ingles dietitian Leah McGrath.
Good Saturday morning. Welcome to the Ingles Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingles dietitian. And for those of you who've listened to the show, you know I really try and present a pretty balanced view of food and nutrition. And I'm not a big fearmonger about food or ingredients. And I think it's important to realize all the different choices and options that we have here in the United States. And particularly when you walk into the supermarket, it's kind of amazing. But it's important also to remember it hasn't always been that way. So I thought it'd be very interesting for all of us, but a little selfishly for me, to be able to listen, talk to somebody who has really taken a look at our food history and can give us a little bit of insight on about where we've come and how we've gotten there what food used to be like, maybe in our grandparents' time or our great-grandparents' time. So I'm have joining me by phone from Texas, Rachel Loudon. And Rachel, would you call yourself a food historian? Is that okay to call you that?
Yes, certainly it is. I study and write about how we got from sort of time before farming to the modern supermarket.
And I can tell by your example, by your accent, you're not a native Texan, right?
I'm not a native Texan, no. I was born and raised on a large working farm in England where we grew acres of wheat and had about 100 dairy cows.
And you're living in Texas, and you're teaching in Texas now as well?
No, my teaching days are over, though I do have a connection with the University of Texas as a research scholar.
Oh, okay. So, Rachel, how did you get interested in sort of the history of food? I mean, you know, we all eat meals, but how did you specifically get interested in researching the history of food? Like, where did that come from?
Well, I was always interested in food, but the chief kind of writing about food was in cookbooks.
Sure.
And I knew that I was not the kind of person who would make a good cookbook author because I tend to be very loose with recipes. And I'd studied geology in England, and I spent many years teaching history of science and history of technology in various American universities. I ended up in Hawaii, which doesn't have a reputation as a big food center, but it turns out to have a very interesting, very eclectic population from many parts of the world. And in order to understand my students in Hawaii, who brought these extraordinary things I'd never seen before into the classroom, I started writing about the food of Hawaii. And that got me on the track to changing from doing the history of science and technology to writing about the history of food.
And what is your educational background? What are your degrees in?
The first one was in geology, and the next two were in a kind of conversation-stopping topic, history and philosophy. Which is, if you really want to know what it is, it's just the study of science and how science works.
So that's just a really interesting path you've taken, because I think at least the way I have gotten to know you is through social media. And I think that, and actually I think others have actually mentioned your books to me prior to running across you on Twitter. And so I really admire you for being on Twitter. How long have you been engaging in Twitter?
Oh, quite a long time. Because we were in Hawaii and then 15 years in Mexico, in both those places, it was important to very quickly jump on to new changes in new communications technology. So we had email accounts from very early on, and I've then moved along with the various new sites that have become available.
Do you find that being on social media, and you're Rachel Loudon, L-A-U-D-A-N, on Twitter, do you find that gets you a whole different audience that you might not normally encounter?
Oh, yes, definitely. And the Twitter audience and the Facebook audiences are very different.
Really? How so?
And I tend to have more academic, that's the wrong word, professional contacts on Twitter.
Uh-huh.
People like you who are in nutrition, or people who are in economics, or people who are in history. On Facebook, it's more people from, well, friends and social contacts from a broad walk of life, many walks of life.
Have you?
But I find both of them absolutely fantastic for meeting people and for getting messages out.
Now, have you run across Alan Levinovitz on Twitter?
Oh, yes. He's a good friend of mine.
Yes, I've interviewed him, and actually we brought him down to Asheville to be a speaker at a celiac disease conference we had right after his book came out. Yes, he's a really just an outstanding person. He's just a lot of fun to talk to,
Yes, he's coming. This week is the big event called South by Southwest here in Austin, and he will be here, so we'll get to meet in person.
Well, please tell him I said hello, so
I'll
give him my best. Well, we're going to be talking with you about sort of your thoughts about the history of food in the United States, and I want to, of course, point people to your book, which is Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History, and the fact that they can find you. Your website is rachelloudon.com, and she's on Twitter, she's on Facebook, and you know, Rachel, I'm so impressed with you. You're very interactive, you're very engaging on social media, so it's very easy to get in touch with you. Stay tuned as we talk more with Rachel Loudon about a little bit about a history of food in the United States and why processed food may not be as bad as you think. Stay tuned to the Ingles Information Aisle. You're listening to the Ingles Information Aisle. This is Leah McGrath, your Ingles dietitian. My guest on the show today, joining me by phone from Texas, is food historian Rachel Loudon. She's written a book called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. Rachel, that sounds like a textbook I would have buy in a bookstore library, but I think that there's a lot to this.
To cooking in world history.
Because I've read excerpts of it and I've heard you talking about it. It's I guess I was trying to say is it sounds like a textbook, but in fact, it's really a much more than a textbook. It really is a look at, you know, where we've come from in terms of food processing, right?
That's really central to it. And I think in terms of the audience in America, one of the most important changes, and I do look over a long time frame because I'm a historian, is the one that really began about 150 years ago. And that's the ability to use more brute force, putting it bluntly, in the kitchen, power. We don't think about how hard it is to turn agricultural products into food. But I lived for some years in Mexico, and there in the 1990s, it's changed now. It was still the case that many women had to grind the corn that they made their tortillas from. And for a family of five, it took a woman 5 hours on her knees with a stone grindstone, just rubbing backwards and forth one stone over another, in order to turn corn into the dough that she was going to shape into the tortillas. Hmm. 5 hours a day.
That had
vanished in the United States way back. And nowadays, our cooking is really just final meal preparation. We have flour that is ready. We have sugar that is ready. We have lettuce that is chopped up. We can indulge ourselves in creating wonderful things in the kitchen if it interests us because we have the time.
Now, you know, one of the things that, like, I hear quite a bit is you shouldn't eat any processed foods. Processed foods are bad for you. And, you know, in my mind, that is just, you know, it's one of those soundbite messages that when you really stop and think about it, like, as you've just mentioned, basically almost everything we eat and drink has been processed in some way. So when you hear something like that, what's your reaction?
Very much the same as yours, Leah, that this is a red herring. Because when people say don't eat processed food, what they are trying to say is don't eat bad food.
Yeah.
But processed food is, all food is processed. So you're just mixing up the questions there. One of the things that distinguishes humans from animals is that we do process our food. We chop it and we grind it and we ferment it and we heat it and we cool it and we let microorganisms go to work on it. And the result is that we are not limited to simply what nature provides, unlike animals. It's just one of the most amazing creative things that human beings have done, is to be able to take the raw materials that nature provides and turn them, say, take grains, into everything from noodles to bread to cake to a dozen other delicacies.
Sure.
It's quite extraordinary.
You know, one of the things that you also hear a lot is from people is that canned foods are bad. But, you know, I can think, as we were talking offline, is that in talking to a lot of seniors, as I've been doing, that they remember that they're mothers, it was mostly mothers or grandparents, had to do a lot of home canning and home preserving. So when did canning become something that was widely commercially available in the United States? What's a time frame?
Exactly in this period I mentioned, around the beginning of the 20th century. It had been around before that, but it had been reserved largely for people who could afford it, the very rich, explorers, and the military.
Ah, yes.
And for ordinary people, canned foods become available really in the beginning of the 20th century. When I was growing up in England in the 1950s, my mother only had a few canned food, a can of tomato soup, a can of sardines, and these were reserved for emergencies because they were too expensive to have on a day-to-day basis.
And so why do you think now that canned foods have become one of those things that are vilified?
Well, because now that we are removed from having to do the work of preparing foods or processing them, if you want to use that term, we can have a nostalgic and romantic view of natural foods. Through most of history, people wanted to get away from natural foods. Eggs went rotten. Fish stank, meat couldn't be kept for more than a day or two, and so people's idea of the best kind of food was food that had been processed in some way to make it last longer, taste better, be easier to digest, and to be safer.
Mm.
Now that we've achieved all those things.
We don't want them anymore.
We don't even remember how difficult that was to do.
Yes. It is a very interesting and challenging time in the world of food and nutrition these days. I want to keep talking with Rachel Loudon. She's, again, the author of Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. Go to her website at rachelloudon.com. She's also on Twitter and Facebook. We're going to be talking with her more about some of the different things I'm hearing in the store from our customers. Stay tuned to the Ingles Information Aisle. Welcome back. You're listening to the Ingles Information Aisle. This is Leah, your Ingles dietitian. I'm speaking with Rachel Loudon. She's a food historian who has a book called Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. We've been talking about a little bit about history of the food in the United States. And Rachel, I have another question for you. What I'm seeing as a dietitian for a supermarket is a lot of brands are, I guess they're listening to consumers or say they're listening to consumers, and they're dropping ingredients. They're going for the quote unquote clean label. They're eliminating what they call consumers don't want hard to pronounce ingredients. When you hear that type of thing, what do you think about all that?
I think I can completely understand why the consumer wants this. It, as you said earlier, it's a very confusing time for consumers at the moment, with a huge amount of choice and a lot of alarmism out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that one way to cut through that for them is to say, well, we want just foods that are natural and simple. I think that's a mistake. After all, food is made up of incredibly complex chemicals. And finally, after centuries and centuries of study, scientists are now able to identify many of those chemicals and give them names. And this allows us and food manufacturers to have more control over the foods that appear on the shelves. The fact that words can't easily be pronounced does not mean that the food is unsafe or has poor nutrition or is some kind of Frankenstein. It just means that food is a complex thing.
And, you know, when you're talking about all the research behind food and the study behind food, there are so many exciting things that are also happening in the world of food that we're hearing about. Everything from eating insects, you know, cricket flour, and meat that's manufactured in the lab, using more mushrooms. Are there food trends or fads that really intrigue you, interest you, and excite you? Like, what are things that you think, wow, this is just, I can't wait to try this?
Well, actually, I'm going to just slightly slide that question. I mean, insects are fine. I ate lots in Mexico. They taste fine. I'm not sure they're the solution to the world's sustainable food, as is sometimes promised, and man-made meats. Well, we've been making meat substitutes. The Chinese started it with tofu many thousands of years ago, but it's a complex business to persuade people that meat is not a highly desirable food. One thing I think that doesn't get enough attention, and that I'm absolutely gape at every time I go to the supermarket, is the packaging.
Ah, yes.
The packaging has a terrible name, mm-hmm. because it's supposed to be wasteful and plastic and, you know, bad for the environment. But when you look at what people want, they want fresh food. They want food that is not canned. And if you look at the vegetable section, the reason we can have, you know, fresh lettuce salads the reason why raspberries can be had in the middle of the winter is because of the amazing, and I wish I knew more about how it's done because nobody's written it up yet for the general public, the amazing new developments in both the packaging, the boxing, the kind of soft diaper materials that soaks up, you know, juices that otherwise would go bad for the raspberries, the kind of inert gases that prevent the fruits going bad. I think this is this is such a transformation in the last 10 or 20 years.
Yes. You're right. There's all kinds of things. There's the cold-pressed juices that are very hot right now that are giving juices a whole different taste, a level of freshness. There's I've seen vegetables that are in pouches, no longer in cans. You know, we had the Tetra Paks for a long time, and now those squeezable pouches of food are everywhere, from baby food to fruits to vegetables. So you can you could be in your car or walking down the street and be eating a serving of fruit or vegetable, just squeezing it into your mouth. It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
It is. Yes.
So you're not that big on the whole insect thing. You're not, that doesn't really wow you.
I mean, you know, I believe the greater diversity of food we have, you know, the more opportunities we have. So
yes.
I'm happy to include insects.
Yes, I think I've tried crickets. That's probably the only thing that I've tried. But I think, you know, I think of it a lot of times the way I think about farming is that it's a tool in a toolbox. I mean, it's definitely an option. Is there anything about food fads or trends that really saddens you or makes you, I don't know, I don't want to say depressed, but that you're kind of concerned about the direction that maybe we're going?
Again, to come at it slightly obliquely, I do find it terribly sad that when we have a greater range of excellent foods than any time in history, no king or emperor in the past had anything like the choice that an American supermarket has, that people are so worried about food. Now, I don't want to say that absolutely everything in the supermarket is wonderful. Of course it's not. But, you know, if you have the minimum of confidence, you really have such wonderful options.
Yes.
And I think we're the first generation in history that's had this kind of choice through most of history, even in my youth. I mean, you either ate it or that was it. I mean, you had no choice. And now everybody has choice. And that takes a lot of learning how to deal with. And I think that's the challenge for this generation and the next generation, learning to approach this wonderful choice with confidence that each individual can really make sensible decisions without having to be knocked back and forth by the latest trend or alarmist or fad food.
I totally agree, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Again, folks, find RachelLowden.com, her book, Cuisine and Empire, Cooking in World History. Thank you so much for joining us on the Ingalls Information Isle.